AI is making waves in every field it touches. President Biden is now on TikTok, and the election draws closer each day. With so much going on in the world, it is hard to keep up with it all, let me tell you. Hi, I'm Kai Ryssdal, the co-host of Make Me Smart. It's a podcast from Marketplace. And every weekday, Kimberly Adams and I break down the latest in business and the economy with short daily episodes to make it easy for you to stay in the know. Listen to Make Me Smart wherever you get your podcasts.
Nomi, you mentioned that you had rewatched Seinfeld with your daughter. I, too, have done a few Seinfeld rewatches. My husband and I did a big one during the pandemic, and then we began again while we were waiting for me to go into labor. And at some point, I had to say, I don't think we can just begin this whole show again every time it ends, like rereading the Torah every year. We can't just have the cycle where this is the sacred text. This is nuts. I need to defamiliarize and be able to come back afresh.
Welcome to Critics at Large, a podcast from The New Yorker. I'm Nomi Fry.
I'm Vincent Cunningham.
And I'm Alex Schwartz. Each week on this show, we make sense of what's happening in the culture right now and how we got here. So today is a show about endings. 24 years ago, the very first episode of Curb Your Enthusiasm aired on HBO.
Were we ever so young?
Were we ever so young? The show was created by Larry David, co-creator of Seinfeld, and stars Larry David as Larry David, or at least a version of Larry David, this wealthy, set-for-life guy who got rich off of Seinfeld and who now can basically spend the rest of his time getting into petty disputes, grievances, social one-upsmanships, you know, all kinds of tricky and prickly interactions with friends, neighbors, wives, you know, what have you.
What is this?
This is my emotional support dog, Pachuca.
Wow. Emotional support dog? What a scam. You know, they shouldn't even let you on the plane if you're that mentally unstable.
Can I give you a hypothetical?
If a guest dropped glasses in the toilet, who fishes the glasses out of the toilet? Is that your department or is it the guest?
Why was it in my face?
Because it was an accident. It was an accidental erection.
What?
It was an accident.
No, an accident is tripping on a step and then also the Titanic going down.
Yeah, but just the way the Titanic went down, this thing went up. It's the same thing. They're both accidents.
So you're saying your penis is like the Titanic?
In a manner of speaking, yes. I think they're comparable.
Save the date.
Yeah.
Are you serious?
That's so stupid.
Larry, everybody saves dates.
I don't save dates. The whole system screwed up. You don't need to send me something to tell me you're going to send me something. Just send it. You know, if I'm saying something to you, I don't say to you, I'm going to say something to you, and then say it. I just say it.
This is the way things are done, okay?
Yeah, it's hard to even synopsize because it's less about, like, a story than it is about the situation. Because it is a show about manners.
Yes, that's
it. It's about, like, what does society ask of us on the level of small interactions and how easily ripped or troubled that fabric is.
Yeah, especially when you have a character like Larry David, the character Larry David plays as himself, who willfully refuses the sort of everyday social contract. Larry's sense of, like, I got something to say, you know, like he's never gonna just let things slide.
Yeah, there's quite literally nothing too small for him
to
become.
There's nothing too small.
To become obsessed with.
Nothing too petty.
Nothing too petty.
Right.
Yes, it's an opera of the petty.
Yeah.
So this past weekend, 12 seasons and almost 25 years later, the very last episode of Curb aired. And that is, you know, something worth noting, we think. Because Curb has been going on forever. It started in 2000. I feel like one thing you could count on, no matter what was going on in geopolitics, in the culture, in society, was that Curb Your Enthusiasm, even if it had a six-year hiatus, would come back, that Larry David would have more to say.
Yeah.
So the fact that Larry David, at age 76, is finally saying, you know, I think I've had enough of this project, that's significant.
Yeah, now the apocalypse can come.
Yeah. It's weird to say goodbye to a show that's been on since you were 16 years old. That makes no sense to me.
That's what we're talking about today. Curb Your Enthusiasm, the show's legacy, but specifically how it ended, and how we feel about it. And we're talking about endings in general. You know, what does it mean to say goodbye to a work of fiction that's become so incorporated into our lives that we never thought we'd have to pull the plug? So that's today on Critics at Large: Curb Your Enthusiasm and the Art of the Finale. Before we begin, listeners, attention. This episode includes a lot of spoilers, of course, because we're talking about the end of things. We're talking about the finales of some of the biggest TV shows of the last few decades. You know, and there's no shame if you haven't made it to the end of, say, The Sopranos, because I'm just going to tell you right now, I'm just going to admit it for everybody. Neither have I. You know, be who you are. But if you don't want to know what happens at the end, proceed at your own risk. Critics.
Yes.
I'm just going to come out and say that Curb Your Enthusiasm is deeply significant to me. It's important to me.
Okay.
I love it so much. Mm. And I want to just say one thing about the character of Larry David. Not the man, but the character of Larry, which is that it's not just Larry who is a curmudgeon. Very often, Larry tries to do what he thinks is the right thing.
Yeah.
He actually feels himself bound by the laws of society. Sometimes he thinks they're absurd and he tries to reject them, or he calls people out on them.
Right.
But often, he really tries to do the right thing, and it's other people who are doing crazy, outrageous things. So I have two examples of this. One is called Survivor. And one of the things that happens in this episode is that a rabbi mentions to Larry that he's having a dinner. I think it's a Shabbat Friday night dinner, and that a survivor will be there. And Larry says, oh, great. You know, I know a survivor. I'll bring my survivor. The survivor Larry's thinking of is someone who survived the Holocaust. A friend of his father's named Solly, who was in the camps. The survivor the rabbi's thinking of is someone who went on the TV show Survivor.
Look, I'm saying we spent 42 days trying to survive. We had very little rations, no snacks.
Snacks? What are you talking snacks? We didn't eat sometimes for a week, for a month.
And so they have a survivor off.
During the day, 98 at night with 98% humidity.
45 degrees below zero.
Did you guys have a bathroom?
A bathroom?
We didn't have one.
We had 12 people at a time would go and shit.
Well, I'm sure you had toilet paper.
We had newspaper.
We had mosquitoes. We certainly didn't have mosquitoes.
You see this glass eye? Huh?
Have you even seen the show?
Did you ever see our show? It was called the Holocaust.
Look, all I know is I was damn close.
The climax of the episode is these two men, you know, one young and fit, one ancient and having, you know, been through the worst that humanity has ever experienced, are shouting at each other, I'm a survivor. No, I'm a survivor.
I'm a survivor.
I'm a survivor.
Incredible.
So in that case, Larry really meant to do well.
Yeah.
You know, another thing I love, another episode I totally love is an episode in which many things go on, including Larry refusing to give two teenage girls candy when they show up at his house on Halloween, demanding trick or treat, even though they have not dressed in costumes or in any way respected the holiday of Halloween. And again, there Larry's feeling that he's upholding a social standard.
Where's your costumes?
I'm being my sister.
You're being your
this
sister.
This is my costume. I'm a teacher.
You're a teacher.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So can we get some candy,
like
Grandpa?
Yeah, no, honestly,
can we
class.
Have our candy?
Yeah, candy.
Hello.
Yeah, I don't think so.
Are you kidding? It's
no.
Halloween.
Yeah, I know. Yeah, it doesn't mean that you're entitled to just go around to people's homes and bilk them out of candy.
Are you kidding?
Yeah.
God, asshole. Fuck you.
The exchange for Halloween is that you either are a child or you're in costume, preferably both. You can't just arrive, you know, shake someone down for candy and then depart. And one of the beauties, I think, of Curb is showing how we all participate in some of these bizarre social interactions, or how we all have these sides that are petty or narcissistic, or just my way of saying that I think Curb has more complexity than may initially meet the eye. I mean, do you guys have favorite episodes? I've just said a couple of mine.
What comes to mind immediately is an episode on season 3, I believe, where Larry goes to New York to do a part in a Scorsese movie. His mother back in L.A. is in the hospital, and he returns from New York and arrives at his parents' house. And he says to his father, so where's mom? You know, she's not in the hospital. And his dad says, she's better. She's not. Yeah. Finally, he says, okay, tell me where she is. Yeah, she died.
We didn't call.
When did she die?
Let's see. The funeral was on Monday.
The what?
So she had to die.
Funeral?
Saturday. Yeah, funeral.
Well, why wasn't I?
Wait.
I'm not at the funeral? What do you mean?
No, no.
Monday was the funeral.
Well, Monday was the funeral.
Well, why wasn't I at the funeral? Why didn't you call me?
She told me not to bother you. You know.
She told you not to bother me? What's that supposed to mean?
And then comes the best part of it, which is like, she said to me, Larry's in New York. Don't bother him. Which is just the most, like, Jewish thing I've ever heard in my life.
Don't spoil his trip in New York.
It's insane!
The woman did not want to bother you.
I missed her funeral because she told you not to call me? Is that what you're telling me?
That's so good.
So I do have perhaps a favorite season. It's season 6. And Larry's wife, Cheryl, later she becomes his ex-wife, but his wife, Cheryl, invites a New Orleans family displaced by a hurricane into Larry and Cheryl's home. We know Leon, who sort of survives this initial encounter and becomes really part of the ensemble, a funny do-rag wearing.
Played by the brilliant J.B. Smoove.
Played by the brilliant J.B. Smoove, who before he entered the world of Curb was a writer on SNL, was a sort of stand-up comedian himself. One of my favorite moments, and it's such a Curb moment, is Larry and Leon arguing over the thermostat. And Larry likes it cold. He wants it on 68. And Leon is like, that's some white shit, Larry.
Let's compromise at 72.
Oh, no, fuck that, Larry. You're my motherfucking man, Larry, but 72? Shit. I'm gonna sleep outside.
Okay.
I'm 82, man, myself.
See there, I told you.
82, that's my shit.
And
that's
you
my
really
fucking region right there.
68, that's just 60
fucking 8. He said 68?
He said 68.
Get the fuck out of here. What the fuck
you
trying to do, man? 68?
Oh, my goodness. Take when you check in hell, it's always
you bring
68.
A honey to the hotel and shit.
Right.
Get up in that motherfucking man. It's all cold and shit.
And then he says my favorite Curb line, which is, I'm an 82 man myself. Which is like, for me, points to my favorite thing about Curb, and it's like, you know, this observational comedy of like where you keep your thermostat.
Yeah.
And another thing it is like Curb works because even when you explain a premise or even say one of the lines, it just works because it's so premise, like setup, punchline dependent.
Yeah.
So let's talk about the finale.
Okay.
This is the 120th episode of Curb Your Enthusiasm. We have to put in like a little bit of a caveat. You know, it might not be the last one because certainly there have been moments before when it seemed like Curb might end. But what we can say for sure is that it is intended to look like and work as a finale.
As a finale, yeah.
You know, so what did you guys think?
I enjoyed it. I did a marathon of the final season.
Mm-hmm.
There was something moving to me about it, not just because it speaks to the history of Curb, but also because it goes back to Seinfeld and the characters of Seinfeld and the fact that Jerry Seinfeld was on the finale. And it kind of like, it's a life more than it's a show. And to me, that sense of completion was weirdly moving.
Okay, so before we go deeper on that, just explain a bit about what happened in the finale and how it was a loop back to Seinfeld.
Okay, yes. So the whole season centered around Larry. You know, he travels to Atlanta. The core of what happens and what, you know, kind of like ends up animating the season is that Leon has an aunt who lives in Atlanta, has
Auntie
a restaurant,
Ray.
Auntie Ray, and she is standing in line to vote. And Larry gives her water.
There you go. I knew this would come in handy.
Oh, yes, yes, indeed. Thank you. For this. Sir, in the navy blazer, put your hands in the air.
Me?
Yeah, you. You under arrest for violation of the Election Integrity Act.
What? What are you talking about?
It is illegal for anyone in the state of Georgia to provide food or water to voters in line at the polls.
What? That's barbaric. What kind of law? Are you serious?
I'm dead serious. You're coming with me.
You can't do it. Oh, no, you're making a big mistake.
I'm sorry, baby. I forgot.
I'm not even from here.
He gives her water and is subsequently arrested. He suddenly becomes this kind of liberal hero, you know, this person who's, you know, seemingly cares about nothing, becomes this kind of liberal hero. And over the course of the season, this is kind of in the foreground and in the background of he has to go back to stand trial in Atlanta. And And so he stands trial. And as, you know, many of you will probably remember, the finale of Seinfeld, which Larry David, after being off for 2 years as a writer on Seinfeld, came back to help write, also ended in a trial where the four characters, Elaine, George, Kramer, and Jerry, stand trial for flouting the Good Samaritan rule. They see a car jack, they don't help, they laugh, in fact.
See, the great thing about robbing a fat guy is it's an easy getaway, you know? They can't really chase you.
It's actually doing them a favor. It's less money for them to buy food.
And what ends up happening in the Seinfeld finale is that they go to jail.
But your callous indifference and utter disregard for everything that is good and decent has rocked the very foundation upon which our society is built. I can think of nothing more fitting than for the four of you to spend a year removed from society so that you can contemplate the manner in which you have conducted yourselves.
People were up in arms about it at the time because they were like, wait, so these people that we've been watching and enjoying for the past however many years are now you're kind of like indicting us with this finale, right? You're telling us that we're bad people for having identified with them. And so the Curb finale is kind of a take on that, where Larry is standing trial for being, you know, an asshole.
Well, actually, he's standing trial for being a good Samaritan.
Well, he's...
That's one great flip in it.
Yes.
That the Seinfeld characters
are
on trial for violating this Good Samaritan law. By the way, this is how I found out this is an actual law in Georgia. I was just like, oh, Larry, there he goes again.
Yeah.
And then I was like, oh, no, this is a
real
law.
No, it's actually
diabolical
real.
Bullshit.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
Because he's a good Samaritan giving out water, he goes on trial. But yes, then
so,
people
yes.
come in to the trial, much as they do in Seinfeld.
Much as they do in
Seinfeld. To testify to the general awfulness
yes.
of his character.
And so it becomes a kind of, in some ways, a kind of clip show.
Classic sitcom device.
Where we see clips from previous episodes all along, you know, all going back to literally the first or second season where Larry is behaving badly.
The state ready to call its first witness.
The state calls Joe Bocabella.
Who's Joe Bocabella? Oh, my God.
It's not Joe Bocabella. That's Boca Joe.
Mr. Bocabella, I understand at one point you were in the coffee business.
Yes, I was.
You know, Mocha Joe comes in, you know, all sorts
an
of...
An antagonist from a previous season. That's
right. All sorts of antagonists.
Yeah, a coffee shop owner who Larry opened a spite store spite next store. To in order
Latte
to put
Larry's.
Him out of business. Yes,
yes,
Larry's.
This almost sounds fantastical.
It got even worse. I got a call in the middle of the night that Mocha Joe's was on fire. And when I got there, he was standing there watching my beans burn.
What did you do?
He burned my beans.
I didn't burn your beans.
You burned my beans.
You know, so basically it's kind of a litany of like what this mm-hmm. bald asshole has done for the past 25 years.
Larry David pissed on a portrait of Jesus Christ in my home.
What?
He tinkled on it. He sprayed Jesus, and not just a little.
Mr. Takahashi, could you please tell the jury what your occupation is?
I own the golf club.
How were Larry David's interactions with the other members?
Oh, he's always disgruntled. And also, he never saved four when he hit the ball. One time, he hit a member in the back with a golf ball.
And he ends up, you know, because he's a bad person, the jury ends up saying that he is guilty. And he goes to jail. And then Jerry Seinfeld comes to the rescue.
All right, Chuckles, let's get you out of here.
What are you talking about?
It's over.
It's over.
You know, kind of like helps show the judge that there should be a mistrial. And Larry is sprung out, you know, verdict thrown out.
Come on, crazy.
You don't want to end up like this. Nobody wants to see it. Trust me. Breathe the free air, young man. Please.
Oh, my God. This is how we should have ended the finale.
Oh, my God, you're right. How did we not think of that?
What I love from the beginning of the season was the fact that
Larry David, both Larry Davids, Larry David, the creator of Curb, and Larry David, the character on the show, were going to go there. They were going to say, oh, no, we haven't forgotten from 1998 that, you know, this was a big bad thing that all the viewers blame us for. Guess what? It's redo time. Not only am I not going to avoid that, I'm going to go right to the heart of it, which is kind of exactly what you expect from Larry David, to go right to the heart of the thing that pissed a lot of people off and say, like, I'm actually going to dig in and do it again. So one of Larry David's famous dictums about Seinfeld was no hugging, no learning. And here, what's kind of great is, yeah, there is no learning, except there kind of is. They admit, Larry and Jerry Seinfeld say, oh, this is what we should have done. They didn't want people to wind up in jail. They didn't like it. There's a teeny bit of learning allowed.
And there's
at the
very a teeny
end.
Bit of hugging, too, I want to say. I mean, there is like, there's, it's not hugging, but there's, and the fact that Jerry springs Larry out of jail, there's like,
it's a bit of a hug.
It's a bit of a hug.
It's as close to a hug as we're going to get.
It's as close to a hug as we're going to get. And when he says to him, go forth, young man. Like when they get out of the cell. Oh, my God. I feel like tears coming to her.
Yep,
what's going
that's
on?
That's it. She's
moved. We'll talk about it.
Oh, my God. Know Me. This is an amazing episode. The goodbye is something that really gets to Know Me. We're getting right to her heart.
No, I'm
literally
moved.
We're going to talk about
Know
Me and endings later on.
This is a history. This is a history of comedy, right? It's not just a history of the show.
It's a lineage.
It's a lineage. It's a legacy. It's like these two men who've been friends for like 40 years, and they're coming together as characters, of course. You know, it's not them. But it calls back. It calls back to so much that has been so important to us.
Vincent, what do you think of the finale?
I will just say that, you know, we have described Curb as a show about manners, and that's correct, but it's also a show about morality on some level. And therefore, I think that this finale works better for Curb than it did for Seinfeld. And it's a show, not to impose Christian ideas on this very Jewish show, but just go with me for a second. It's a show that proceeds in this very, like, bland, sunshiny universe where there's no weather, there's no... there's only one time of day almost.
Yeah.
It's kind of a purgatory. And then so that it would end in this very judgmental way, I think is so appropriate for this show in a way that, like, it was kind of a break from the realism of Seinfeld. But this ending, the trial, all the callbacks, almost pointed out the comparative surrealism of Curb. It's like, this hasn't been a world. It's been a balancing scale of justice all this time.
Oh, really?
And,
like
and
that,
finally,
yeah.
We arrive at an answer in some way.
In a minute, we'll talk about some of the most celebrated and some of the most maligned series finales of all time.
I might want to talk about Sex and the City, guys. I'm sorry.
No, I want to talk about The Hills, even sorrier.
Stick around.
And if you are watching this video, either I'm dead or I'm in a very, very, very bad situation.
She said, oh my God, I can hear gunshots. I can hear men outside.
Where are they? What have they done to them? Are they dead? Are they not dead?
There is one suspect, her father, the Sheikh.
It's Madeline Barron from In the Dark. We've teamed up with our new colleague, Heidi Blake at The New Yorker, to try to answer a question about one of the richest men in the world, the ruler of Dubai.
Why do the women in Sheikh Mohammed's family keep trying to run away?
There is 5 policemen outside and 2 policewomen inside the house. So basically I'm a hostage.
And he reminded me that Sheikh Mohammed can get me anywhere.
Because you're a rich and powerful person, you can effectively break any law you want in our country and get away with it.
The Runaway Princesses is available now. Follow In the Dark wherever you get your podcasts.
So we've been talking about endings that satisfy us.
Mm-hmm. Mm.
Vincent, you famously have watched in the past year Sex and the City for the first time.
Amazing.
I know you have thoughts about the ending of that show.
What, you're not even going to tell me who he is?
His name is Alexander Petrovsky.
You're moving to France with a Ruski? Oh, come on. It's a joke, Carrie.
You do this every time. Every time. What, do you have some kind of radar? Carrie might be happy. It's time to sweep in and shit all over it.
What? No, no. Look, I came here to tell you something. I made a mistake. You and I...
You and I... Nothing! You cannot do this to me again. You cannot jerk me around.
Carrie, listen. It is different.
Oh, it's never different. It's 6 years.
You know, the ending, the two-part, the Paris, the whole, you know, hullabaloo.
The hullabaloo.
Would Big come over and save Carrie Bradshaw? What was going on with the Mikhail Baryshnikov character? I mean, what do you make of this today, having just watched it?
What I make of this, Alex, and what I make of that finale, is that I'm just someone who is looking for love.
Oh, damn.
Real
oh my
love.
God.
Oh, damn.
Ridiculous. Inconvenient.
You're just a
can't
girl.
Can't live without standing. Each other love. And yeah. I don't think that love is here in this expensive suite. In this lovely hotel in Paris. It's not your fault. It's my fault.
He's doing it.
I shouldn't have come here.
Oh,
yeah. Okay. So it was beautiful.
Wow. You came prepared.
I came ready to talk about it because it's great.
Deny the power of those lines. I dare you to deny them.
Chills. Chills.
They are good because they belong to a genre and that they satisfy, you know, at a certain point, Sex and the City was not always a rom-com. It was more of a sort of like a Chaucerian, like, you know, like body episodic thing that just existed to give us, again, like scenarios and situations. Somewhere in the middle of the fifth season, it started feeling that it has to achieve an ending, starts to create itself, push itself into a genre, and then therefore satisfy the sort of hopes and expectations of that genre. You mentioned the last year I have watched this show. Not even, I mean, whatever, let's call it 5 months or something. I've slowly
and then quickly
masticated this show. I have loved it. And mostly on my in my apartment, let's face it, disastrously high. And again,
what's, a bit of a bad boy, Vincent.
A bit of a bad boy. Did I smoke and watch Sex in the City? Like, it was like the most middle-aged thing I've
ever. Yeah, rebel.
But, you know, what was so touching about that for me, and I guess this goes to what we're talking about, was that it marked the ending of that texture in my life. I'll always remember that because of where I was, how I decided to consume it. I'm grateful for that ending because of the way that it put a button on an experience and serves as a kind of metaphor for that experience.
I mean, one thing I will say, I take your genre point about Sex and the City, that it tried to switch genres and it wasn't, you know, just going to stay in its fun Chaucerian mode forever. But the whole premise is we're not going to stay, you know, fun girls in our 30s forever. And some are more anxious about that and some are more relaxed about that. But it is about a transitional period in life. I mean, this is making me think of one of the great endings of recent memory, which is the Succession ending.
Ugh, yes.
I mean, there may be dissenters, but I think people by and large agree that it was a great ending in part because it didn't try to slip the question of an ending. The show was called Succession, and I think a lot of people did wonder, you know, are they going to – we're so used to being dangled over this chasm of like, well, we'll never know, will we? The screen has gone black with Tony Soprano. You know, you're never going to know. And that's so cool. And that I think it really was cool. And The Sopranos did it. But all of us are so used and abused by non-endings that I think many of us were like, OK, well, maybe we'll never know who actually becomes the head of Waystar Royco.
Right.
Yeah. No, you're going to find out.
We're going to know.
We're going to know.
That's
it's
true.
Going to happen.
Yeah.
And it and happen.
Jesus,
it did.
You're a fucking like you went for an empty fucking suit? Oh, yeah, maybe you should vote it through. Hey, yeah, maybe.
Come on. I know you. Like, you wouldn't if it was the other way around.
You know what? Good luck. Yeah? Good luck, motherfucker. Because we have the numbers. Yeah? Good fucking luck. It's Tom.
What?
It's fucking Tom.
Tom?
Yeah, let's go. Let's fucking go. Man. Let's run our numbers. Let's go.
Fuck by the dry cleaner.
It was a kind of tragedy of, like, what happens when the one thing that gives life meaning for these people, which is, like, seeking their father's love, and, you know, by dint of that, like, who will, you know, kind of succeed, when that gets taken away from them.
And when they have to actually tear each other apart to do it. I mean, the way that the show ended with, you know, being denied success by her very own sister.
Yeah.
Kind of like.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And, you know, just to, from the sublime to the ridiculous, I just want to note MTV's The Hills, the, you know, one of my favorite reality shows ever.
Can you say a bit about The Hills?
Yes. So The Hills was actually much like Seinfeld and Curb. The Hills came on the heels of Laguna Beach, an earlier reality show on MTV. Do you remember that, Vincent?
I do remember both. That's right.
You know, high school youngsters living and loving in the Orange County town of Laguna Beach,
that's
California. A few main characters, Elsie, Lauren Conrad, you know, as a kind of the queen bee. There was her nemesis, Kristen Cavallari, who was a sort of like hot up-and-comer, like a year younger, junior to Elsie's senior. The, you know, sequel, The Hills, followed Lauren. And the finale, so Elsie was already gone. She had left. Kristen Cavallari was the heroine. The main animating tension of the final season of The Hills was, will she stay with Brody Jenner, Caitlyn Jenner's, you know, son? It ends with Kristen and Brody saying goodbye.
If I would have known that if I were to go and see somebody else, that you would leave town because of that,
I'm not.
I probably wouldn't even have done it, because I don't want you leaving.
I mean, that's, God, hearing that, that's all I've wanted to hear from you, but I still have to go.
She gets into a limo and drives off, okay? But then what happens is that suddenly it is revealed, there's like a pan out of the camera, and it's revealed that this whole thing took place actually on a backlot of a studio. And so it was a very meta comment because was clarified to people in a variety of ways that this was very much scripted.
Right.
And so in kind of breaking through the fourth wall, The Hills winked to the audience and said, yes, you're right. This is fake. But also, aren't you moved? You know,
did people feel betrayed?
People felt a little betrayed, but I think people also liked it in a way. They were like, oh, this is.
It's kind of an artistic ending.
It was kind of artsy. And, you know, if we're thinking about like, okay, there is a kind of like weight put on the ending, this is a classic example of like, okay, this is clarifying a lot of kind of questions that people have had about this show for like several years.
So what is the art of a good finale, and where have showrunners gotten it right, and where have they gotten it very, very wrong? Critics at Large from The New Yorker will be right back.
Hi, I'm Deborah Treisman, fiction editor of The New Yorker and host of the New Yorker Fiction Podcast. On the podcast, I ask a great contemporary writer to select a favorite story from the magazine's almost 100-year archive to read and discuss. Together, we delve into the story, exploring its themes, its style, and what makes fiction work. You can listen to authors like Otessa Moshfegh talk about why we write.
Story, or attaching a story or creating a story, is this inclination that we all have to stop spinning.
And you can hear writers like George Saunders discuss the nature of storytelling.
On the first read, you accept these things as descriptions and they make you see the scene, but every line is a chance to inflect the reader's mind.
You'll discover new favorite authors and read old favorites in new ways. Episodes of the New Yorker Fiction Podcast are released on the first of every month. Listen and follow wherever you get your podcasts.
I think finales do tend to yield strong reactions. I mean, we're saying goodbye to our friends.
That's right.
That's very often how it feels. How do you guys do with endings?
There's something weird that I realized, and I guess I didn't really think about it, but looking back, I was like, wait a second. I watched The Sopranos the whole way through, and I didn't watch the finale. I just, for some reason, something has kept me from watching it, which is crazy. And so I remember that. And then when we were like, okay, what other finales are we going to talk about? I was like, wait a sec. This happened with Mad Men, too.
Another very famous finale.
Another very famous finale.
Beautiful
Again,
images.
Again, watched Mad Men the whole way through. Loved it. Loved The Sopranos as well. Cannot watch the ending. There's something about closing off this fictional universe that depresses me, I guess.
So is it a little bit about, do you think it could be maybe about like the end? Because I do think there is something with very good fiction, very successful fiction, where it does have a life. And the ending kind of gives a sense of how artificial that life was all along. That the closing off of possibilities, as you say, really makes it clear that this whole thing all along was constructed.
Yeah, it must be something like that.
I, first of all, would like to say that I am fine with finales and tend to think that they are overemphasized.
You're not infantile like me.
No.
Don't let me watch it, mommy.
No. Because I guess my problem is less like sort of about endings or goodbyes. My problem is about like how much people, I think this is a failure of reading, honestly. And I hate to sound like maybe snobby about it, but I just think that people place too much like aesthetic judgment on endings. I think most fictions, whether they be televisual or happen in prose or whatever, are about texture or about what happens on every page. And therefore, this idea of an ending ruining the show is alien to me and ridiculous. Unless it tries to make us analyze something in a different way, makes like we were all asleep thing or whatever, you know what I mean? It's like, otherwise, it's just an episode of the thing, you know what I mean? And so it's less about the goodbye thing, which I think is actually reasonable and I think is such a like a soulful and beautiful way of thinking.
I'm just
worried. I just like don't like the analytic pressure that endings accrue. Like everything cannot be so we beat on boats against the current. The end of Gatsby, right?
Fine, but can you deny Vincent Cunningham? Can you deny that a perfect ending can do much to elevate a work and give it a sense of unity? Because I'm all into your opting out, you know, you're too cool for endings gambit. I see it. I like it. And I myself,
they're
you
not
know,
more important than beginnings and they're not more important than middles.
But can you deny that sometimes just the right ending, such as the one from The Great Gatsby you cited, gives a sense of true cohesive unity to the work as a whole? It's not just another line on the page. It has been placed just so for a purpose, and it can really contain and elevate the entire work.
Since we are on some level talking about comedy, this is what I'll say about the ending. The ending is like the art of the callback in comedy. It is a maneuver. It's a kind of a trick. What it does, yes, is create a unity, and it does further the impression, which is always an impression and illusion that the artist is like one step ahead and on a higher plane of like sort of a vista than us. We like to feel that we are held in a pair of hands. And yes, that is one of the great things about art. And so I won't contest that endings are different, distinct.
Yeah.
Are they better? I don't know.
I think, you know, we have been talking about TV, and I think for a specific reason. I mean, yes, the occasion for our show is Curb Your Enthusiasm, but something, it occurs to me that something happens with TV and maybe a few other media, but not all. And I think it has to do with duration. Because TV takes place over time, it really becomes integrated with the texture of life. I wonder if that's one reason why when a TV ending doesn't work for an audience or falls flat, there is a real outcry. Like, there's drama when a TV ending doesn't work. I'm thinking of Game of Thrones, for instance, which was, of course, a huge, some call it the end of monoculture. I mean, you guys know I'm a little monoculture skeptic, but most people were very pissed off by the ending. You know, there are other examples of this. Lost is another one that comes to mind, where people who had really been watching for years and had been very faithful to the show felt totally let down. And I'm wondering why that is. One idea I have about it is that it does, again, for me, come back to the nature of what fiction is and its unstable relationship with reality. I think what we do when we watch a show like Game of Thrones is really put ourselves so fully in the hands of these fictional creators and let them take us to all sorts of places mm-hmm. that I think it feels very much like a betrayal when the fiction doesn't pan out in a way that, you know, viewers find satisfying. And I wonder if part of that is just like a sense of, oh, humans were behind this. Mm-hmm. This yes. wasn't happening on its yes. own and following this perfect world.
Yes.
Oh, and they got it wrong.
And they got it wrong. Yeah, yeah. I think that's really true because as you were speaking, Alex, I was thinking, okay, what is this meaning of watching a TV show week after week, year after year, sometimes being really connected to it? It's because it tells us something about life. It explains something to us about who we are, if that's not too sort of highfalutin to say, like, you know, this is kind of a metaphysical thing. And crucially, it's done by a person who knows more than us, right? I mean, it's almost religious, right? This is what's going to explain life to us. And I think both in the idea of an ending in and of itself. So it's like, oh, so this isn't going to go on and explain my life to me, like, until I'm dead, you know? And also in the idea of an unsatisfying ending, there's a sense of, like, it's like finding out, like, a guru is, like, a sexual assaulter.
Oh, my God.
I mean, you know what I mean? It's like it's you believe like in something. Yeah, it's just like
it's just
that.
Just like that.
No, but you know what I'm saying? It's like you believe in something.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Bigger than yourself. Someone who has more wisdom.
And has given you pleasure.
And has given you pleasure. Wisdom. And has given you wisdom. And has given you an answer. And then the answer is
Some bullshit. Yeah.
Or, you know, I mean, it doesn't need to be bullshit, but it's not satisfying in some way.
Yeah.
It's fumbled. And you're like, wait a second, but I thought this was like how I was supposed to live my life in a small way. You know, I'm not saying people are living their lives according to Mad Men, but you know what I'm saying.
Yeah, it's I think that's a very good point.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, I think that's super well said, and I totally agree. Because I do think this brings back up for me this issue of morality. Just as fiction has an unstable relationship to reality, it also has, I think, a more troubled relationship to morality than we often admit. You know, when someone puts a situation in front of us and that situation eventuates in some, like, result, it always, I think, triggers in us a response of, oh, so do you think that that's what should happen? Like that the what is and what should feel more closely implicated in fiction than they do in life, I think. Mm-hmm. And yes, sometimes we need to fight this impulse, but I think it is always there with us.
Yeah.
And therefore, you know, if something bad ends up happening to a character that we love, you know, death, imprisonment, whatever.
Simple disappointment.
Right. Yeah. Simple disappointment. The something that comes up for audiences en masse, I think, is did so-and-so deserve that?
Yeah.
I think about, you know, Walter White in Breaking Bad. It's mm-hmm. like, is he going to get caught or not? Because mm-hmm. it will explain to me what I'm supposed to think about his descent into criminality or whatever, right? Mm-hmm. If X happens to X person, what will I think that it means that this writer thinks about life? And I think that's a big question to ask about, you know, we've been letting this writer, you know, as the guru, as you say, Naomi, pull us around for years. And so now I get to, I think it's mistaken, but I think it's the nature of fiction to make us indulge in this mistake. Now I get to know what this person thinks about what life should be like or is like. So that's a big thing to finally, like, have settled, I think.
Right. Maybe that goes back to the Seinfeld finale in a way of just, you know, oh, we thought the show was about one thing and mm-hmm. the enjoyment of watching some of these, you know, narcissistic and antisocial behaviors play out. No, it's actually about them being judged. Whoop. You know, there goes the rug being pulled out from under our feet. We don't like that.
Yeah.
I mean, you're making me think about something else also. This is a bit of a different example. But, you know, when Louisa May Alcott wrote Little Women, mm-hmm. that book became an absolute huge runaway success, and her readers really wanted Jo March to end up with rich boy Laurie who lived next door. That is the ending they wanted. They had had this kind of childhood friendship, uh-huh. and that is what they wanted. And that was not at all what Louisa May Alcott wanted to have happen. In fact, she did not want Jo to wind up with anyone originally, I believe. Right. She I think at first Lucy Malicott had contemplated having no kind of romantic tie-in mm-hmm. for Joe. And then she does do one, but she does one that totally defies readers' expectations. That, to me, is about a lot of things. But one of the things it's about is about the author saying, no, actually, I'm in charge. It's not you guys. Not all fiction is fan fiction. You've done your job almost too well if this person has come alive for people in that dramatic way. And you don't want to be told what to do. But the fact that you are being told what to do means that you've done the thing right. It's right. That kind of funny Gordian knot of where fiction becomes real and reality becomes fiction, mixing and blending together. Yeah. And that's really tricky. And I do think that goes to why people feel betrayed, because these characters, things, scenarios, whatever it might be, become really real.
Yeah.
Before we go, after all this talk of the Seinfeld finale, we should just say that as we were recording this, Jerry Seinfeld himself was in the studio next door to ours, recording an interview for the New Yorker Radio Hour.
I really wanted to follow him to the bathroom, but my co-hosts kept me in my seat.
We have to maintain some kind of veneer of professionalism,
I guess.
But if you want to hear that conversation, and I do, he's talking with David Remnick, keep an eye on the New Yorker Radio Hour's feed in coming weeks, because I know I will be.
Same here.
This has been Critics at Large. Our senior producer is Rhiannon Corby, and Alex Barish is our consulting editor. Our executive producer is Stephen Valentino. Condé Nast's head of global audio is Chris Bannon. Alexis Quadrado composed our theme music, and we had engineering help today from James Yost, with mixing by Mike Kutchman. You can find every episode of Critics at Large at newyorker.com/critics, and you can email us at themail@newyorker.com. with the subject line, Critics. See you next Thursday.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, The New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.